The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member at tntradio.live. From climate change to energy and environmental matters, you're listening to Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT for our continuing our show today. It may sound like a conspiracy theory, but Sky News in Australia reporting new cars are now going to be delivered with, quote, driver-facing cameras to monitor your facial expressions while driving. Yes, conspiracy realities outnumber conspiracy theories. Clip one. Let's take a look.
But first, if you're in the market for a brand new car, you're about to get more than you bargained for. A lot of the new cars are coming with driver-facing cameras that monitor your facial expressions while you drive. So if you yawn while you're driving, an alarm will sound and a message lights up on the screen telling you perhaps you need to take a break. Or if you look at your passenger for a moment, an alarm sounds and a message pops up saying, keep your eyes on the road. Of course, the irony is to read the message that says, keep your eyes on the road, you have to take your eyes off the road. Now, these are all designed to ensure driver safety, but critics say it makes cars less safe because they're quite distracting. And Liz, plenty of married people would say one backseat driver is enough already.
I don't know that it's about that. I mean, if anything, this could get the wife off your back. But I just hate that here is yet another implementation, all in the name of keeping you safe. Mm-hmm. It's all in the name of keeping you safe. And yet we know, of course, this is literally surveillance inside your very car, which is a very personal space for a lot of people. You have private conversations in there, and what you do in there is your own business as long as you're not hurting.
This is quite disturbing because this comes on the heels, and I reported this earlier this week on Unleashed on TNT. Not only are we going to have these driver-facing cameras, but you also have patents coming out from Ford Motor Company that can remotely disable your car, turn off the air conditioner if you get behind on a car payment. Beijing can remotely stop your electric car from your Chinese-made EV, which are going to be globally dominating the world. Why not? They have the cheap labor. They have a monopoly on the rare earth mining. They have no environmental standards, no human rights. They can produce everything dirt cheap. They can remotely stop cars. I reported on that yesterday. Bloomberg News has reported on the Ford patent that shuts off your air conditioner. They did a patent filing on that. Elon Musk was urged by many people to deactivate all the Teslas in Russia. Apparently, you could do that remotely from anyone who bought, any Russian citizen who bought a Tesla. He refused to do that. We have power companies remotely could switch off EV chargers. And I've already told you that it says here to reduce the electrical grid stress. Well, or say there's a virus that Bill Gates funded scientists at the WHO say, hey, we need stay at home orders. You don't have to issue a lockdown. You just say, I'm turning off the national charging grid. Once you ban gas powered cars and everyone's stuck. Oh, my God, I can't charge my car anymore. How did this happen? Anyway. This is the world in which we live in. And I was unaware of this driver-facing camera that's going to be monitoring us. And again, this is what they want to do. The OB, the onboard diagnostic computers in these cars, there's been many scares about where they're headed with these. They're like a black box on an airplane. They can monitor your speed. They can monitor all sorts of things. There's also ways they want to have breathalyzers built into the car to see if it detects alcohol. It would automatically disable your car before you could even start it up, not by breathing into something, but just by breathing in the car. So this is the kind of things that are happening, and this is the kind of stuff we need legislation. Again, Rand Paul, who I praised before, has been one of the people. I remember he was fighting the breathalyzer, and also Thomas Massey, again, Kentucky. Who would have thought that they would have the only representatives pretty much that are that strong? Well, this next one is more of a populist issue. I live in Virginia in the United States. The ugliness of what's happening with these, they're called the cloud sharing server buildings, the cloud buildings. from Amazon, from Google, Apple, all the big tech companies. And they're literally Soviet era architecture springing up all over Virginia, DC, Washington, DC suburbs. They're ugly as hell. They're along highways. They're along interstates. They're along side roads. They're in neighborhoods that you can see. They are literally Soviet era, Eastern European style block buildings, many cases, no window, made out of cement, as ugly as you can, with zero architectural codes. Now, you know, you have local community standards. This should not be allowed. Now, the reason it's allowed is they're paying huge amounts of money. The local politicians, boards of supervisors, state delegates, pretty much when you have money like that, you can pretty much do whatever you want, especially if you target smaller areas. And so what's happening is we're just losing in visual architecture is a very important part of life. When I went to parts of the Eastern Bloc, I've been to the Czech Republic, I've been to Poland. It's depressing, not the historic, not going into downtown Prague or not seeing the historic old, you know, Polish buildings, but seeing anything built from the late 1940s through the 1960s and Soviet era domination. Of course, it went on longer. In the 70s, would even worse in the 80s. It's depressing. It sucks the human psyche when you see ugly architecture, drab, mundane blocks. And that's what's happening. So also what's happening is the mom and pop stores going, even the more vigorous, you know, chain stores, meaning vigorous, meaning serving your community. And what's popping up everywhere are dollar stores, specifically Dollar General. And this next clip I think is important because it just goes to show you how, yeah, this is a private business, but it doesn't mean they shouldn't face, you know, serious regulation and serious pushback from local communities. Makes you want to boycott a store like this. It's all crap that they sell anyway. And, you know, little cheap plastic stuff and expired food, but it's cheap. And this is the economy which our elites have delivered us to the point where Dollar Generals are needed and they're one after ever. So this is clip two. It'll explain a little bit better what I'm talking about these dollar stores cropping up in rural America. I was mentioning the architectural part about the cloud service, the cloud buildings from big tech as part of this whole thing to just take away people's joy. Clip two, Dollar General.
I've begun to really see Dollar General as like a criminal organization.
You're stealing from my community. And I think they're very aware of it.
It's a classic bait and switch.
Somebody at the top is making a lot of money.
Go for a drive in any American county, and you'll likely soon pass by the yellow and black lettering of a Dollar General. Drive a little further, and another will appear. Then another, then another.
Here's the other Dollar General store. It's 7 miles from the last Dollar General store we were at.
With nearly 20,000 Dollar General stores in 48 states, the Tennessee-based discount chain has sunk its teeth into lower-income, rural, and suburban areas everywhere.
It's easy to look at the dollar stores and think they are a sign of economic distress or a symptom of economic distress, but what we found is that they're in fact a cause of it.
Underneath Dollar General's so-called low everyday prices in convenient locations lies a sinister business model and a massive scandal that hardly anybody knows about.
The fact that we have to sue a company to get them to tell the truth is absurd in my mind to begin with.
And that, by the way, that report is from More Perfect Union, which is a nonprofit media organization with a mission to build power for working people. Again, More Perfect Union produced that segment. And I'd urge you to go to their YouTube page, More Perfect Union, because they go on. And what this basically is Dollar General comes in all these rural areas, with opens up with very cheap prices, drives out all the competition. It's a classic sort of bait and switch. And then they go through and they detail, and it's part of this growing lawsuit against Dollar General. I think it's going to be a class action lawsuit with many different communities. Once they clear out a lot of the competition and they get everything, they start raising the prices on things well beyond from when they opened. And again, they can afford it because they're running out, because A, our economic policies are crap. And especially in rural areas, the deindustrialization and everything that we've had in America, environmental regulations, et cetera, have destroyed every kind of a base. And I'm sure COVID lockdowns hurt these kind of chains like Dollar General can survive. Small mom and pops cannot. So they go through and they talk all about sort of the price bait and switching that's happened with Dollar Generals all around. And they've taken him to court. Dollar General's fighting this. But anyway, More Perfect Union, I thought it was a great story to just show you sort of the decline, economic decline of what's happening. All right. RFK Jr. In fact, by the time it could be happening right now or within a few hours of this broadcast live, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. will have announced his extraordinary vice presidential candidate. Let's watch clip three of what he's looking for in a vice presidential candidate for his independent run in 2024 for president in the United States.
Hey, everybody, you probably heard by now that I'm about to announce my running mate, the person who will serve as my vice president. Those press reports got some of the details wrong, but on March 26th in Oakland, I'm going to straighten it all out. I'm going to announce that day an extraordinary running mate who's going to be my partner in governance. I can't tell you who it is right now, but I can tell you that I could not possibly have found a better partner governing this country. And I'll give you another hint. This announcement is really going to shake up the political establishment. I'd love for you to join me in Oakland to welcome this dynamic individual into our campaign. We're about to take my campaign to a whole new level.
And as I'm broadcasting this live, they have the event. I see Cheryl Hines, RFK Jr.'s wife, at the event, and I don't think they've officially announced it yet. And some of the names have been like Jesse Ventura, Arnold Schwarzenegger, but some of the names I've never heard of. And I think actually that's the last rumor I saw. It's going to be some San Francisco donor to his campaign, some Bay Area, San Francisco, California, Bay Area, who's going to pick. We'll get back to you later in this program if I can confirm who the pick is. I'll try to take a look during one of the things there. So this is Poland. This is 70,000 agricultural workers brought the country's road network to a standstill this past week. Remember, we opened up the last hour talking about the EU halting the European Green New, I guess I keep saying Green New Deal. They call it the Green Deal over there. They eliminate the new part. EU fails to advance major climate bill. Plan to fight climate change was indefinitely postponed due to farmers' protests sweeping the continent. So reports the Associated Press. We'll watch this next clip. This is clip five. 70,000 agriculture workers, farmers, basically bringing road networks to a standstill. Let's take a look. And those farmers have been out, again, every Western country, some of the Eastern Bloc countries, including Poland, Romania, and I shouldn't say Bloc anymore. The Soviets don't dominate the Eastern Europe anymore. I'm so used to saying Eastern Bloc, like it's the old, you know, East Germany and under Soviet domination. But they were able to halt this Green Deal in Europe, and it's a remarkable thing. Now, there's an election coming up in June in Europe. Let's hope that we could have a shock election. And let's actually hope we can vote out these members of parliament and actually have a majority of anti-net zero politicians. I don't even think there is any such politicians in Europe other than a small minority, but we'll see and we'll hope. This is a great vote. Again, a lot of the Hungarian delegation is being credited with being the key swing vote there. Okay, on the same token, we were talking about shutting down small business. This is Oregon, a report about Oregon shutting down their small farming. Small farms under assault, clip four.
It seems like these types of stories are starting to become so prolific, you could almost do a video a day on this stuff. But today I wanted to talk about the state of Oregon. And I know that some of you are probably thinking, you know, this is Oregon, this is what happens in Oregon. But hear me out on this, because a lot of these things kind of start in some of these states, and then you start seeing them spread to other states. Okay, so the state of Oregon has effectively shut down small farms and market gardens on a large scale. and they're actually sending out cease and desist letters to farms, and they're using satellite technology to find their victims and then send them these letters and say, you can't operate. And they're doing it in the name of water conservation, groundwater protection.
And this is it. All these regulations, all of this, we're going to save the groundwater. We're going to save the species. We have under the net zero commitments in Europe, farmers have to set aside up to 20% of their land for trees in return to nature, which would reduce their crop yields, their profits, their ability to even own the land or keep ownership of the working farm. This is how they come after you. And it's all couched in this, you know, oh, we're here to protect the earth. Let's wrap ourselves in that mantle. We're not totalitarians. We're not people out to destroy economic base and everything. Don't worry. We're going to provide universal basic income for all the people who lose their homes and jobs. We'll provide net zero public housing, as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez announced last week, net zero public housing. That's their solution, and universal basic income. So you can go to sleep at night with your guaranteed annual minimum check, guaranteed minimum income from the government at the same time with a smile on your face because your building is net zero and it's saving the planet. Don't worry about the crime and the plumbing that's broken and the light fixtures that haven't been fixed and the smell and the deteriorating. Doesn't matter. Your building is part of the effort to save the planet. And that's what net zero public housing is all about. All right. Breaking news. I do have the information. It just came in as I'm broadcasting live here on Unleashed on TNT. You're witnessing history on TNT. RFK, this is according to NBC News, just breaking news in the last few minutes. RFK to name attorney Nicole Shanahan as his vice presidential pick. Huh? Who? He was talking about Arnold Schwarzenegger, Jesse Ventura. He was talking about the former Green Bay Packers quarterback, all sorts of famous people. He's doing name an attorney, Nicole Shanahan. What is going on here? The attorney and entrepreneur has never run for elected office. Oh, well, let's see what NBC News says about this. Again, breaking news on TNT Radio. Independent presidential candidate Robert Kennedy announcing that Nicole Shanahan, wealthy attorney and entrepreneur in the San Francisco Bay Area, will be joining his campaign as his vice presidential selection. Shanahan, like Kennedy, has never run for office. It's going to be official within moments. Kennedy's pick comes as a key inflection point for his campaign. Let's see who this lady is, because I don't know much about her at all. And Kennedy considered a number of potential running mates, including New York Jets quarterback Aaron Rodgers. I think that would have been a great pick. I don't know if he would have done it. Former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura. I would have supported that. I've always liked Jesse Ventura. Former Democrat Rep. Tulsi Gabbard. She pulled herself out of the running long ago. TV host Mike Rowe. I would have supported that. By the way, Rowe described his interview to ABC News saying Kennedy ran through the key policy positions and defended his anti-vaccine advocacy. Anti-vaccine, right. Shanahan had previously was involved in the production of the Super Bowl ad supporting Kennedy in November. Okay. What is the Nation magazine? This is a left-wing publication. They're not happy that RFK Jr. Here's their headline. RFK Jr. brings super wealthy vice presidential pick on board. Nicole Shanahan has little to recommend her as a presidential running mate besides her, drumroll please, enormous wealth. Gee, I don't know. I think I'm agreeing with Nation magazine's analysis so far. Kennedy said about a couple of weeks ago, I would never choose a vice presidential candidate based on how much money they have. And of course, the Nation gets very upset saying that's exactly what he did. Kennedy is independent run for president. He says he certainly didn't pick Shanahan. This is the Nation magazine, left wing. He didn't pick her because of her political acumen. Shanahan bragged that she was a driving force behind Kennedy's Super Bowl commercial, which was a repurposed 1960 campaign ad for his late uncle, John F. Kennedy. She's contributed $4 million to the super PAC, I guess, that supports RFK Jr. And NBC News reports there's no such record of a contribution. So I don't know what that means. Anyway, it goes on. She's chosen as his running mate. The woman who claims credit for an ad, he says he didn't approve. People thought the ad was, quote, ghoulish, according to this, because I guess it tried to turn him into his late uncle. Anyway, choosing Shanahan helps Kennedy in at least two ways. 23 states require an independent to choose a running mate before seeking ballot. Shanahan can use her wealth to fund the complicated legal maneuvers and signature gathering that that process requires. And it's a mess. I've worked on independent presidential campaigns. I worked for Howard Phillips, who I mentioned yesterday in my interview with Doug Bandow, which I really enjoyed, by the way, going through the history of the U.S., but I worked for Howard Phillips in 1992. He was trying to get ballot access as the U.S. Taxpayer Party. He also came on, we went to Massachusetts to qualify. I went to Massachusetts for a couple of weeks of my life to qualify on the Independent Voters Party there. We had a six-way debate, and actually one of the people we ran against was the Prohibition Party. And yes, this was 1992. This was 32 years ago. Gosh, I feel old all of a sudden. I guess I am old. In 1992, I worked on that, and we actually debated the Prohibition Party in Boston, Massachusetts, and along with Bo Greitz, a Vietnam War hero, and a couple other people who I don't remember off the top of my head now. But I always like to joke, Howard Phillips, the candidate I worked for, one, he went and ran the Conservative Caucus. He was a former Richard Nixon aide. He won that, I think it was six-way presidential primary of the Independent Voters Party for ballot access in the state of Massachusetts. He won the primary. And I always like to say that I was part of the effort working for Howard Phillips that set the Prohibition Party back 80 years. Of course, they lost their main cause and with the Prohibition ending. And, oh, geez, what was it? I don't want to be stupid here. I think it was 1929, 1930 when prohibition of alcohol ended in the U.S. Anyway, they were still out. But we won ballot access. I can tell you right now, ballot access is a mess. It's a nightmare. It's designed for independence. It's designed to keep the two-party system and to keep, you know, just another barrier to entry. So if you picked this lady, Shanahan, again, never heard of her. Breaking news, Nicole Shanahan, uber wealthy donor to the RFK Jr. campaign, is now his vice presidential pick. She's from California. And here's one thing I did not mention, which I do not like. I do not like. I don't know the details behind this. She is the ex-wife of Google co-founder Sergio Brin. And that is disturbing because Google is no friend. Hold on, let me just see this. Shanahan, besides the wealth she controls, partly thanks to her five-year marriage to Google co-founder Sergey Brin, and she also has investments in her own high-tech investments. So I don't know. That sounds like maybe she's turned against big tech. Maybe she's turned against, you know, all the stuff that she was married to. But odd pick, I've got to say. For someone like RFK to continue capturing the public's imagination, because he's done a pretty good job. He should have picked a Jesse Ventura. I guess he couldn't pick an Arnold Schwarzenegger. I don't like Arnold anymore. Remember, he's the one that said, you know, screw your freedom when it came to anyone opposed to COVID and mask mandates. Anyway, I don't think this is going to help him. It may help him financially, That's about it. No one's ever heard of this lady. I doubt most Bay Area residents of San Francisco have heard of this lady. Her only real claim to fame in the pop culture, she was married to the Google co-founder. I know nothing about her, never heard of her. I'm kind of disappointed. Aaron Rodgers, imagine him as a vice president. Jesse Ventura, imagine him as a vice president. That would have been exciting. This is not exciting. Not exciting. But anyway, you got to hear it. You got to see it live. That was breaking news on TNT Radio. Hope you enjoy that. And we have to take a break now. When we come back, Nicholas Giordano will be joining us. He's from Campus Reform of Higher Education. Wow. And do college campuses need a lot of reforming? We'll be right back on Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We're going to talk with Nicholas Giordano. Stay tuned.
TNT's Chris Smith.
I can tell you that Donald Trump is projected to win primaries in the states of Texas, Minnesota, Colorado, Virginia, Maine, Massachusetts, Arkansas, Alabama, Oklahoma, Tennessee, and North Carolina. And in a little bit of a turn up, the northeastern state of Vermont looks to have gone to his rival, his final rival, the former United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley. Now, Nikki Haley's team has said that she won't be speaking tonight. That has been construed by many of the reporters in that location as she's about to exit the race in the next 24 hours.
Chris Smith on today's News Talk, TNT.
In a democracy, the majority vote rules. But in most democracies, you can only vote for change every 3 or 4 years. To understand what people want, governments and political parties use focus groups. These focus groups can include as little as 20 people. Australia is a country of over 25 million people. Does making decisions based on 20 people sound fair to you? Have your say. Be heard in between elections. Download the For My Say app now. That is number 4, My Say.
CO2 sustains all life on Earth, but now it's in long-term decline. We face the return of an ice age. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, joining us now is Nicholas Giordano, Campus Reform Higher Education Fellow, Professor of Political Science at Suffolk Community College, and the host of the PAS podcast. Welcome to the program, Nicholas.
Thank you for having me on, Mark.
All right, tell us a little bit, what is Campus Reform of Higher Education Fellow? What exactly does that entail, and what issues do you work on?
Well, we're like a watchdog group, right? So we were founded in 2009, and essentially what we do is we call out the radical indoctrination that's taking place on college campuses, how our education system is failing not just the students of today, but future generations, and how we need serious reforms. I mean, we see attacks all over the place on things like free speech. We see professors trying to shut students down. We see raging anti-Semitism. And there's a lot of anti-Americanism that has been infused into curriculums throughout college. So Campus Reform exposes all this, and everyone can check out campusreform.org.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that culture. When did it really begin in earnest? Now, obviously, universities, if you go back to the 1950s, if you sent your kid off to a nice Ivy League school, do they come back indoctrinated? If you said in the 1960s, of course, you'd have the hippies and the free love and the Vietnam War protests and all that. So I guess that was radicalizing. You know, has it ebbed and flowed? Were the 80s better than the 70s and 60s? Can you just give us a little timeline of what is going on with college campuses? Are they always been this bad, or is this the worst they've ever been in terms of this indoctrination wokeness?
Well, this is the worst they've ever been. And obviously in academia, it's always skewed to the left, but there was a major difference. I mean, when I went to college, I had far left professors. Some of them were avowed communists. But they loved education, and they loved debate and dialogue. They loved when I would push back, we'd have the discussions in class, and they were subject matter experts in their field. So even if they, let's say, disagreed with something that the Founding Fathers may have written, they would still respect the Founding Fathers. They wouldn't bash the United States. They wouldn't bash our founding and our history. Then we saw a shift, and I wrote an article about this on Campus Reform that talks about how we went from educators to ideologues, people that went through high school, then they go to college, they get their bachelor's degree, they move on to grad school, end up getting a PhD, and then they go into the classroom and teach. And what happened was the fact that these are people that weren't steeped in the subject material like a previous generation. And so they substituted what they didn't know with their own ideology. And they felt that, hey, I'm the professor, or I'm the teacher in a K-12 class. I'm the one that knows it all. You didn't go through all the schooling. It was an arrogance that emerged amongst these people where you couldn't question them. And I think that's where it changed. You know, a lot of times people don't realize, but prior to, you know, the 1990s and 2000s, in order to teach, you needed to get a degree in the field that you were teaching. So I teach political science. I had to get degrees in political science. I also have a degree in Homeland Security. However, when it comes to teaching today, especially in the K-12 system, you now have to take education courses as well. And these education courses are where you start to see the indoctrination, because no longer is it about the subject matter expert that knows their field. Now it's about learning different teaching techniques, which are important. I'm not stating they're not, you know, the different, pedagogy that exists, but they lost an element by getting rid of some of the classes that would have made them the subject matter experts. So I think that the ideology has changed amongst educators, where too many ideologues have gotten to the field and they're just pushing their ideology as opposed to just teaching the subject material.
Well, I've heard a theory. I don't know if you can, if you have any shed any light on this. It was after the big Wall Street debacle 2008-09. It was a corporate strategy, essentially, to push wokeism. And the idea was, yeah, we're guilty of all these heinous financial crimes, but let's virtue signal. Let's start talking about, you know, racial, gender, and all these other woke type issues. And this is where that whole movement was born. The funding, the whole idea is you can't criticize us because we're LGBTQ. Who cares if we've screwed over all the investors? And that dripped into academia and then became, you know, much more part of our culture. Is there anything to that theory that sort of this was a corporate billionaire? And one other point on that, it's been reported by the National Legal Policy Center that Warren Buffett from Berkshire Hathaway had given Bill Gates all this money. And one of the things they did was push for gender toolkits in kids, critical race theory. So is this coming from corporate world billionaires dripped into academia, which then makes it to our children? Or if not that, that's just the theory. Do you know where this came from and why, like in the 2000s, it started ramping up? Where was the source of it?
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because prior to the financial crisis, when you had corporations and they needed to give back to the community, they'd build like a YMCA clean up the park or something, something that was non-political. And that's the way they gave back to the community. Then all of a sudden you have the Great Recession and all these banks begin to get bailouts. And all of a sudden, these banks and the financial institutions begin to start talking about social issues and the importance and taking positions on the social issues, something they never would have done 20, 30 years ago. In fact, not only did they start talking social issues, they also started pushing policies. So if you look at a Bank of America or HSBC, well, they decided that no longer are they going to allow, you know, gun stores to have accounts in their banks anymore. And because they don't believe that guns should be sold to children over the age of 18. And so it doesn't matter what a state legislative body does. We, the corporations, will now start to dictate policy. And you started seeing the corporations starting to get very political after they received the government bailout money, which shows you that there are strings attached whenever you're receiving bailout money. So I have little doubt that corporations played a role. Now, did corporations do a hostile takeover of college campuses? No. However, they certainly influence college campuses. And then on the other side, it's government grants, right? The federal government provides billions of dollars in grant funding to higher education institutions. And Dwight D. Eisenhower warned about this in a farewell address. People may remember his warning about the military-industrial complex, but he actually warned about how a nation's scholars would be hijacked with the government grants that are going to these institutions to fund research. Because if you have to apply to the government for a grant, well, isn't the conclusion pretty much baked into the cake? I mean, you kind of have to conclude what the bureaucrats want you to conclude in order to keep the grant money coming. And so Eisenhower warned that there is a hostile takeover going on inside our academic institutions, not for necessarily nefarious purposes, but because wherever there's money, there's going to be corruption. And that, I think, it happened. The system became corrupted. And now, again, you have the ideologues in government that don't know how to put their ideology aside to do the mission. And you have the ideologues in the classrooms. It's a very bad environment. Okay. You don't want all these ideologues. I used to be in Homeland Security. I worked within Governor Cuomo's administration for the New York State Office of Emergency Management. Never once did I allow my political ideology to get in the way of the mission that I was doing. Unfortunately, today, ideology is driving individuals both in government and higher education.
Well, and most, you know, aside from what you'd call the woke agenda, the most profound thing I saw was just the killing of free speech on college campuses. I mean, how could the 60s radicals, who you think are, you know, the genesis for the woke generation, how could they support what we see on college campuses. Say, I spoke 2019, Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and they had a whole orchestrated thing to shut down my climate talk. It was climate change. And of course, I was a climate skeptic. They infiltrated the audience in about 5 minutes into my speech. They had a whole coordinated messaging. They would not leave. The security came in, couldn't even remove them. And they shut down my whole speech for an hour. And then we had to resume later. But my point is, we see this all over the place, whether it's Riley Gaines talking about transgenderism, whether it's Ann Coulter, whether it's anyone talking about any issue controversial to the left. They're shut down, canceled, threatened on college campuses. How did the war on free speech become the ground zero in U.S. colleges?
Well, because the nonconformists became the biggest conformists, you know, the ones that were always like, rah, rah, fight the system. They became the system, and they're totalitarians at heart. I mean, they really do have authoritarian tendencies where they don't even allow speakers to give their thoughts and opinions and then just rebut them with ideas and questions. Instead, it's they want to shut the speech down in total, and you faced it, many others faced it. And this is something that goes against the entire idea of higher education, where debate and dialogue and search of the truth is essential. That's the whole point of higher education. Unfortunately, our educational institutions have deviated from this, and you have two factors. You have a faculty and administrative class that believes that only certain points of view should be prevalent on campus. And if there's anything that they deem as harmful, it should be relegated to some free speech zone on an obscure part of campus where nobody's going to hear you. The second problem is the student body itself. These are people that are entitled. They believe that their voice should matter more than everyone else's. They're willing to shut anyone down. And a lot of that's a result of lack of accountability. I mean, if we look at college campuses, any student that attempts to shut down a speech should be immediately penalized by the administrators, by the academic deans. They should be either suspended or, if in any case, depending on how egregious the situation is, possibly even thrown out of the school, because we can't allow a handful of people to shut down speakers. Today, it may be you, but tomorrow could be anyone else. And that's what they don't realize. As quickly as this turned on conservatives or libertarians or anyone outside the mainstream narratives, well, it could quickly turn on them as well. It really is disgraceful. And at Campus Reform, we've been harping on this free speech issue because it's actually even worse than that. What a lot of people don't realize is that there are many colleges and institutions that implemented what's called bias reporting systems, where students can levy complaints against other students and faculty members for things that they say that that person deems offensive, as if they're the arbiter of what's offensive and what's not. However, the problem becomes, well, what happens when you weaponize these bias reporting systems? Again, a bias reporting system should not exist on college campuses, and yet they've been built out. It's like Big Brother on steroids in the United States right now, and people need to wake up to that.
All right, well, the question is, what would you tell parents sending their kids off to an Ivy League or some other very expensive school facing hundreds of thousands of dollars in costs? Do you tell parents it's not worth it today? Are the schools, I mean, aside from this whole woke agenda and the indoctrination, are they at least giving them a good education if you want to be a doctor, a lawyer, a businessman? Or has that all been suffered as well? What advice would you give to parents and students looking at colleges? Do they need to go to college? Is it that dark of a place now that they should actually seriously consider alternatives?
Well, it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, so it really depends on people's individual situations, but I can tell you what I tell my students, and I always tell them, first of all, look at what you want to major in and look at the career you want to get into, something that's fulfilling, and be mindful of what is the salary versus how much does the degree cost. Like, it doesn't make sense to take out $200,000 in student loans to be a police officer or a teacher or something of that nature. So you don't want to go to college and take out all these loans when you could have just went to a two-year school or a state four-year school, saved a hell of a lot of money, and graduate with very little student debt. So first, they have to be mindful of what they want to do for the rest of their lives. Secondly, we need to get rid of all the useless degree programs out there. I mean, I tell my students, I'm not trying to be offensive, but if you want to major in Caribbean studies, there's going to be a nice line for you on unemployment when you graduate, because you're not going to be able to find a job. I mean, you know, the fact that these institutions even offer some of these useless degree programs is almost criminal, in my opinion. They shouldn't be offered, because they know damn well that that student is going to have a difficult time obtaining a position after that. I encourage all students to start off at a two-year college. You don't need to go right away to the four-year school. Start at the two-year college, get your feet wet, and you literally, I mean, a two-year college costs 10% of what a four-year school costs. So it's that much cheaper, and you save a fortune. And a lot of jobs today are moving away from four-year degree requirements. So 45% of employers in a recent survey stated that they're doing away with four-year degree requirements. This follows IBM, Google, Bank of America, and other big companies. And then you look at that and you say, okay, well, so for some people, it's not worth the four-year degree requirement. Others, it will be. I mean, if you want to go to med school, if you want to become a lawyer, if you want to be, you know, in the healthcare field, in a nursing capacity, you're going to have to go through college education to get that. For other positions, you're not going to have to go. We've also seen states move away from four-year degrees. Virginia, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, they are dropping four-year degree requirements in their positions as well. So as far as parents go, first of all, you have to sit down with your child and speak to them to see what ideas they have, what they want to do. Secondly, you have to investigate the schools, you know, do some research, determine. There are some great schools that do exist out there. Now, you know, I can't endorse any of them, but there are schools that do promote free speech, that do respect it, that promote American values and traditions, that don't promote this anti-Americanism and the woke ideology that we're seeing infect our society today. So do your research on the schools that your child is thinking about applying to. And then also, we have to understand and recognize. Now, everyone's been told that in order to succeed in life, you need a four-year college degree. That's a lie. That's a myth. Okay, you don't. You could get a two-year degree. You could learn a trade. If you want to start a business, you could open up a business. It's about drive and determination. And so you really need to see, well, am I an academic or not? I mean, if you're not an academic, because not everyone is an academic, then maybe you want to consider learning a trade and it will be more useful to you. Maybe you want to consider becoming an entrepreneur and learning about business and the business environment. And so those are all things that should be taken into consideration where parents are making their decision. Now, as far as higher education goes, it's always going to serve a purpose and it's going to be useful to a lot of degrees. If you look at any advanced civilization in modern times, well, they lead in academics during their success. Now, if you look, the United States has been declining, both in K through 12 system and the higher education system. We've moved down several rankings over the course of the last 5 years, I believe it's 5 years in a row now, in the international university ranking system. As our education system has declined, well, look at our nation. That's been in decline as well.
All right, we're talking with Nicholas Giordano. He's from Campus Reform Higher Education and also a professor of politics at Suffolk Community College. We take a break. We'll be right back after these messages on Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT.
My baby's back from the West Coast.
Hear those pictures that you asked for your school project? First day of school, cute as a button.
So long ago.
Oh, here's Grandma Florence after that flood wiped out the whole neighborhood.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Ah, those beans smell heavenly.
Give Mama a little credit.
You know what? We should make an emergency communication plan. That way we're ready this year.
Oh, great
idea. At my dorm, we have emergency kits for earthquakes and wildfires, but I'm sure there's something more local I can send you with the link.
Okay.
Smart.
I'm coming to share with you guys.
Protect your legacy. Plan for natural disasters today. Visit ready.gov/plan.
Whatever happened to good?
It's a word that gets thrown around a lot, and it's become our automatic answer to so much.
Hey, how's things?
Good.
Your mom, your weekend?
Good, good. Is good even that good anymore? At the Selbos, we believe good deserves better. Let's reclaim its true meaning. To us, good has always been about making a difference, and good never picks or chooses who it helps. Isn't it time we all remember what good really means?
From climate change to energy and environmental matters, you're listening to Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, we're continuing our talk with Nicholas Giordano. He's the Campus Reform Higher Education Fellow and Professor of Political Science at Suffolk Community College. All right, you've laid out a very good case of why colleges in America are in bad shape. Essentially, how do we get us? Do you have hope that there's going to be any serious reform of this in terms of getting rid of the indoctrination, allowing restoration of free speech, bringing costs under control? What can we do? And is this going to be, are we going to be in 10 years worse than we are today, in 20 years, or do you see this situation improving?
I actually see it improving. I mean, it better improve for my sake, or else I'll be out of a job because colleges will be going out of business. No, I do think it's going to improve. I wrote a piece that if we don't reform, we're going to face a reckoning. That was a couple of years ago. That reckoning is now here. And colleges have begun to notice. Enrollments have been declined. Obviously, parents and students are growing concerned about colleges and where they're at. You also have employers that are now walking away from schools, not requiring the four-year degrees. And the big thing that's happened over the last few months is that donors have begun to cut off their funding to these nice endowments that many of these colleges have. So if colleges don't reform, if they don't change their ways, then they will go out of business. And I do think that you do have administrators and professors that do recognize that and are trying to reform the system now. It's not easy. It's not going to be overnight. But I do think that over the long term, our higher education systems will one day get back to the concepts of merit, hard work, academic integrity, and excellence.
All right, and I believe there's a bill, House Republican bill defending free speech on college campuses. What exactly is that bill, and shouldn't colleges already have adopted this? Or what is the bill, or what kind of reform are they pushing in Congress?
Well, this bill is about cutting off funding to any college that denies people their right to free speech. What's interesting about this bill is the fact that we shouldn't even need a bill. I'm not taking a position of whether the bill should be passed or not, but we have a First Amendment in place. It's called part of the Bill of Rights in the United, amended to the United States Constitution, and it guarantees free speech. So it's really aggravating when we see lawmakers introducing bills like this because it's completely unnecessary. With all the problems going on, we shouldn't even have to talk about this issue because it shouldn't be a question of whether or not free speech should be respected on college campuses and within our society. But that's how far we've come. The fact that you have people like Richard Stengel, former Obama administration official, state publicly that free speech is a design flaw of the original Constitution and not what the founding fathers really intended. You know, free speech was just fine until the masses got a voice. Now free speech is all of a sudden a problem.
Yeah, I mean, and you have this whole movement of misinformation, disinformation. You have the online fact checks, which the fact checkers are basically funded by billionaire organizations to basically support whatever the government and establishment want them to say. They don't allow any dissent. How do we dismantle that whole agency? You know, we almost had the disinformation board, under President Biden. With Nina Jankowicz and that whole thing. I mean, how did Americans be so willing to give up their free speech? Does a lot of it have to go back to COVID when, I think it was that scary, frightening survey that showed Democrats, majority of them were favoring the vaccine mandates and people like losing their jobs and other harsh things if they didn't go along with the COVID restrictions. How did America become to this state where huge swaths of our population support suppression of free speech, support things that you would say are against freedom, especially what we endured with under COVID?
Well, I think that's the failures of our education system, 20 years of failures, and we're seeing the results now. I mean, the fact is that most Americans don't know the United States. They don't understand the United States and the system the Founding Fathers set up. And the overwhelming majority couldn't even pass a basic citizenship test. They have no idea what freedom of speech really is and why it's so important. They don't understand concepts like limited government because they were never taught it. In fact, there was a huge mindset change, particularly after September 11th, but even a little bit before, but after September 11th, there was this huge mindset where we have to trust government, where government's trying to keep us safe and secure. And that goes against the very teachings of the Founding Fathers, who actually warned us, always be suspicious of government, including the government that we're creating, because it's not a perfect government. There are flaws, and there's only one trajectory of government is growth. You just brought up misinformation and disinformation. Well, first of all, governments throughout history have been the largest purveyors of misinformation and disinformation. Like, that's indisputable. Then they also add, I don't know if you know this, but they also add something called malinformation now. So misinformation is information that's false that you spread, but you don't know it's false. Disinformation is information that's false that you're knowingly pushing. Malinformation is information that's true, but can be deemed harmful to the general public.
I don't know that I've ever heard that. That is terrifying. Where is that coming from, our government or academia? Where is malinformation coming from?
That's coming from the Department of Homeland Security, your Department of Homeland Security, where you have Jen Easterly, the CISA director, that wants to take cognitive functions and declare cognitive thoughts as critical infrastructure protection, classified under CIP. It really is terrifying, but it shows you the intent. They want to control. It's not about censorship. People will talk about censorship in the general view, but it's about controlling what people see and what people hear and what they could watch, what they could say, because if you could do that, then you could control their thoughts and opinions. And that's the real goal. And higher education has actually helped build out this apparatus. So the University of Wisconsin received, I believe the grant was about $5 million taxpayer dollars to build out a system called Course Correct that goes, looks for misinformation, and then corrects it in real time in newsrooms throughout the country. This is on top of the $7.5 million that was granted to several other institutions to do the same thing, to fight this idea of misinformation. So you have the unholy alliance of higher education and the government merging into one to be the ones that are going to be the guardians of speech to determine what can and cannot be said. And that is frightening, because it was higher education institutions that built out the Total Information Awareness Program in the early 2000s to the tune of $100 million that led to the impetus of the CIA's PRISM program that collected metadata on every single American.
Well, let me ask you, you said you were the Homeland Security with Governor Andrew Cuomo. Is that what you said in New York?
Emergency Management, Homeland Security. Yep. I worked in New York State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Services in the Office of
Let me ask you a question. If you're looking back in time, do you think we should have had the creation of a federal Homeland Security? Should the states have had this? Or has this led to sort of the surveillance state upon which we are now living?
Well, it directly led to the surveillance. I mean, it's been a good career for me, but it's directly led to the surveillance state. So I remember when September 11th happened, I was in my final year of college. I wrote my entire thesis on the idea that we better be careful. We're treading in unknown waters. We're granting enormous power to government. And if you speak out against it, well, then people say, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, why do you care? And people viewed with suspicion. But I warned about it even before I got into the idea of emergency management and Homeland Security. And the apparatus was going to be built out regardless either way. I think that people are now recognizing the beast they've unleashed. Because let's be honest, I mean, the Department of Homeland Security is enormous. And it's a $1 trillion industry now. Funds, you know, other subsidiaries out there as well. Well, how do you begin to rein it in? And this is the question, like I always ask, if we defeated, let's just say we completely obliterated Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and all the terrorist organizations, well, then we don't need Homeland Security anymore. So there always has to be a perpetual threat in order to keep the gravy trains running. And that's people don't realize the financial incentives to hype up, to amp up the situation and stoke fear. But we saw it during the coronavirus, right? I mean, we saw unconstitutional decrees, and we saw an entire populace that was willing to allow government to lock them in their homes, determine when they could go to school, when, where, and how they could practice their faith, what businesses are essential, which ones aren't, what you must wear when you leave your homes. It was really authoritarian when you think about how state legislative bodies were completely bypassed, and yet the majority of Americans didn't have a problem with it. That was terrifying to me.
Yeah, and that really, I think that was the moment. We're still living under, by the way, the 9/11 emergency declaration. We almost would have still been living under the COVID declaration, and now they want to do a climate emergency. There was a BBC historian who said, throughout history, the greatest abuses of civil liberties have occurred during times of emergency powers, during crises, and I think that's right. Well, we're out of time, but thank you so much. This Nicholas Giordano, Campus Reform Higher Education Fellow and Professor of Political Science at Suffolk Community College. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
All right. And this is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We will see you next time. Thanks for watching.